Look up idiot in the dictionary, you know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I am your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am woefully ignorant of many films, filmmakers, and genres that consensus has deemed important, and thus I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month, I'm exploring the Universal Classic Monster movies, as recommended by Gavin Mevious. Specifically, I am doing them in double feature format, and so this week's episode, I'll be talking about Todd Browning's 1931 Dracula and Carl Froon's 1932 The Mummy. One very minor note before I get into the episode is just, it is obviously October right now, which means two things for my apartment. One, football season in the bar downstairs, and two, radiator heat in a pre-war building. And anyone who lives in, well, a pre-war radiator building knows what that means. It was hissing at me a little bit when I came home from work today, so I'm hoping that both of those elements kind of keep as quiet as they possibly can be during this recording and this episode. But that does mean that, I suppose, for the next couple months, I am going to be combating hissing, clanging, and an unseasonable temperature in my apartment as I try to bring these episodes to you. So I certainly hope you'll forgive me for that this week, if that is a factor, and I certainly hope that you will be forgiving to me as we move into fall, into winter, and it gets colder outside, and the boiler becomes more hell-like, if you will. Perhaps hellish was a better word, but you know what? I went with it. So, okay, so let's get into the episode. I am intimidated. I am intimidated by this aspect of doing double features. I've never done this in I Do Movies Badly history before, and I told Gavin off mic a bunch of times that I was very intimidated by it, but you know what? I'm watching some great movies. I'm watching some important movies. I'm watching some classic movies, so I'm excited by it at the same time, too. So I'm not really sure, or haven't really been sure as to how I should approach these episodes. So at least for this one, let's see if it works out. I think I'm just going to talk a little bit about both and then kind of conclude by sort of discussing their similarities and bring in a conversation from a comment that somebody left on one of my episodes, because I think it kind of ties into how I ultimately wrap all this stuff up. But I think I'm going to, you know, a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B before I guess talk about column C. I don't know. But especially because in my first note here I have for Dracula, how much more can I add to this conversation? And this is something I've mentioned a few times on this podcast, just as the idea of some of these movies are so classic and so important, and there's such cultural significance behind them, such cinematic significance behind them, that I'm not really sure what I can say that's going to be new, or at least the things that some of the things that are going to be relevant to me or resonant to me are going to be things that have been resonating and relevant to people over decades. So even if I take the personal angle of, hey, this is what was cool to me, I'm still probably going to be repeating, you know, some words that people have spoken multiple times before. So that was the first thing I had to Dracula. But we moved on, and of course, I mentioned on the introductory episode that I've seen Dracula before. But I guess it was a while ago, because I realized how little I remembered of it, or at least how much of it was new. It was a new enough experience where I felt confident that I could at least do an episode on it and kind of rediscover stuff, which is cool. And one of the things that I rediscovered, we start out, because it's one of the very first things you see once Renfield gets to Castle Dracula, is some of the production design and the shooting is really inventive. I don't think in the entire movie, and I'll certainly get to that, but at least in the introductory scene, when Renfield first meets up with Dracula and in Castle Dracula, there's some really wonderful production design, I can't describe it as anything other than just the Gothic architecture, the old, broken down, cavernous, but massive, architecture that they have. And the sets that they built for this were expansive enough and I guess impressive enough where, according to the IMDb trivia, they reused these sets over the years for other movies, including, while they were shooting this one, a Spanish version of Dracula that they were shooting at night. They used the exact same scenes, and I can see why, because it's very, very impressive. And Browning, at least in those castle scenes, does a really good job of balancing when he uses wide shots versus when he uses close-ups, because when we are first introduced to the character of Dracula, it's not so much in a close-up. I mean, it's sort of a medium-wide, but it's certainly not close-up. We certainly don't get that Bela Lugosi glare in those eyes until a little bit later, once he and Renfield have moved into Renfield's bedroom. It sounds kind of sexy. That's also something I suppose I'll get to in a little bit. But I think what that does, setting it up like that, is not only the shooting in wide shots, and so much in wide shots, where Renfield and Dracula are both in the shot as small characters. And I'm saying this, of course, watching on a large screen TV, on a Blu-ray nonetheless. But it kind of shows not just the immensity of the design, but it also kind of sets up a good mood, in the sense of Renfield is sort of dwarfed and overwhelmed by the situation that he has found himself in. And by positioning Dracula at the top of the stairs, Renfield at the bottom, it sort of immediately shows the power structure, how it's going to be, with Dracula being the master and Renfield being the servant. And that's kind of how it sets up immediately. This is sort of the relationship between these two characters, and Dracula is this looming, lording character who's going to be a who's going to cast a metaphorical silhouette over everything that comes after him. And I really, really appreciate that. But then once they get into the bedroom, it kind of cuts more to the standard sort of close-up shots. And then once you see Bela Lugosi, and I really did start noticing how great Bela Lugosi is in this role. I mean, this might be commonplace, of course, and this role to a certain degree plagued Bela Lugosi until his death, until he was buried in the Dracula cape and outfit, because the two things became synonymous with each other. But I just sort of noticed how perfect he was, and I know that he lobbied hard to make this movie, and even took a reduced pay because he played the role in the initial theater, and the movie is based on the initial play, not as much on Bram Stoker's original novel. But he wanted it so bad, and I can kind of see why. He seems such a natural fit for this. Like, the way that he, I don't know, the way that I saw his expressions, how he was sort of cryptic, but he was also had this cold courtesy towards, not, it starts with Renfield, but it kind of extends to everybody that he meets. And I was reminded of, it's kind of a weird thing to say, but if anyone was ever into UFO lore now or when they were kids or whatever, and you kind of hear stories about people that have encounters with Men in Black or these paranormal figures and they describe them as sort of acting human but not feeling human, like, you know, they're kind of going through the motions of being human. That's what I felt with Bela Lugosi inhabiting this role, is sort of like Dracula is a character who knows the etiquette of courtesy and knows what he should say, and sort of knows, okay, at this point I should smile, but it doesn't seem natural. It seems so sinister. Even his smile, even his courtesy seems so sinister, and that's done, and that's from really some subtle, fantastic work from Bela Lugosi. And I had seen this movie before, but Bela Lugosi's influence or legacy, I guess, was always kind of lost on me. Instead, I would just think of, like, of course, you know, his character became obviously iconic. You know, you see that even if you've never seen this movie, even if you're, you know, a young person and you don't really know who Bela Lugosi is, you've never seen it, but you can see him dressed up as Dracula, and you immediately kind of know that conjures an image, that conjures a thought. You know, that because the slick back hair, the not tuxedo, but the suit that he wears, the cape, all of it, that became the iconic image of a vampire. You would show that to somebody and it was immediately like, vampire. Even if you didn't think Dracula, they saw that, they thought vampire, and that continues still to this day to a certain degree. And it's kind of funny because I know we've taken these old mythologies and we've taken these old legends and we've tried to modernize them. We certainly have. It's not a good movie, and it's certainly not a popular movie, but, you know, you had Dracula 2000, you had Hugh Jackman's Van Helsing, you have the Twilight movies, you have all these efforts to sort of update vampires and the vampire story. And to me, I've always really been in love with the idea of the gothic, the old school, and I think that ties into what I love about horror films of mythology versus science, and that's something I'll get to later as well. But I thought that Bela Lugosi was absolutely fantastic. I thought the guy that played Renfield was a little bit too over the top, in a goofy sort of way. Dracula works in some weird humor that doesn't really make sense or doesn't seem to fit with the tone, and is primarily embodied in Renfield once he goes mad. And I forget his name, but there's a caretaker or a guard, someone at the sanitarium who kind of looks after Renfield. They kind of have, it's almost like a sitcom where it's the two of them, like a madman and an aloof guard, are this comedy duo, which seems really out of place in a movie that has a lot of undertones of darkness and sexuality and other things that you may add to the conversation. But I guess let's actually get into the sexuality conversation, because I don't want to spend too much time just on this one. I do want to move on to The Mummy, but one of the things that I guess film analysis, that film critics, that real hardcore like film writers and nerds, the kind of stuff that you read in classes called like Essence of Cinema and that sort of stuff. I took a class, by the way, called Essence of Cinema. It's one of my favorites. But some of the stuff that you read about vampires and monster movies is sort of how, obviously what they symbolize as, in society, in culture, in gender roles, in, class structure and that sort of thing. And one of the things that I've read, and I'm sure if you've done any sort of academic reading, especially in the horror genre, you'll have read this as well, but that idea of the sexuality behind vampirism, and specifically when it comes to this idea of an infection that spreads from one person to another, specifically through penetration. The vampire teeth obviously have a passing, not significance, a passing resemblance to a phallic object, and that phallic object is piercing through the body of someone else, most notably or most recurringly a woman. And then they are infected by some type of condition which has made this person, this male, a vampire in the first part. And of course, it's not exactly a hop, skip, and a jump to get to the metaphor of sexually transmitted disease in that analysis. But one thing that actually kind of struck me about Dracula when I was watching it now was actually sort of how asexual he is. And I say that recognizing that his main object of desire is Mina. And Mina is a very young, very attractive female, and she is not the one that he kills. She is the one instead that he shares his blood with and infects her. Doesn't kill her, but infects her, turns her into, or starts to turn her into something like him. And so it's a lot. I can see it's very easy to jump to the conclusion of it, being a heterosexual thing, especially considering the fact that she is the object of desire. She is on the other side of the male gaze. But speaking of the male gaze, there is a certain, and this was something that it seems like is a little bit lost nowadays, at least in the vampire stories we kind of tell, but this idea of sort of the hypnotic glare and having some sort of a telepathic connection between Dracula and the victim. But there's at least this hypnotic glare where he kind of enchants people and they, he kind of makes them do what they want. And that glare, which is captured wonderfully, by cinematographer Carl Freund, excuse me, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but he was the cinematographer on Dracula, ended up becoming the director for The Mummy, which we'll get into a little bit. But by just kind of like, essentially he two small holes in a piece of something and shining light behind it and pointing that light indirectly in Bela Lugosi's eyes, and that, has become a magnificent and iconic shot of Dracula's glare at his victims. But that glare that hypnotizes these people, that kind of draws them to him, that is the same whether it's a male or a female. So yes, Mina is the object of it, or seem like she is the object of his desire, because she is the one that he attempts to make like him, whereas her friend Lucy is just killed. Kind of continuity errors, we'll get to that in a little bit, and where Renfield is sort of turned mad, not really, their relationship seems to be a little bit different, but the one thing that all of these characters have in common at first is that glare that he gave them, is that hypnotic sort of gaze, is that male gaze. And it's the same for all of them, whether it's male or female. He gives the same look to Renfield that he gives to Mina. and he bites Renfield just like he bites Mina. The only thing is, because of sensors and what have you, we don't see the bites in either of them. And actually, according to the Internet Movie Database, the studio wanted to have the scream when Renfield was bit kind of cut out. And they wanted the scene, actually, the entire scene of Renfield being bitten cut out, which you don't see it, of course. It fades to black before there is any kind of bite of any kind. But they wanted that cut out because their studio note was something to the effect of, you know, did I write it down here? I did not write it down here. But Dracula only, you know, Dracula only attacks women. And yeah, I guess so, but Dracula can attack whoever he wants. Dracula can bite whoever he wants. Dracula can gain sustenance and blood from anybody he wants. And so I saw it instead as yeah, he's a heterosexual figure of menace, I suppose. But only because of censors and only because of, I think, at the time, what sort of people we're comfortable with. Whereas I see it now as Dracula is sort of gender agnostic. At least that allure, that gaze that he gives, that's the same for everybody, you know, because it is, there's sort of a, as I see it, sort of a hyper objectivity to Dracula. You know, yes, you know, women are objects, but really just any person is an object to him because he can bite anyone. And so I saw that, and maybe that sort of, you know, me watching this movie here in 2016, where certainly LGBTQ rights are becoming more acceptable, and they're becoming, and that's, you know, and it's, they're becoming more of a regular part of society here, and you know, rightfully so. And I'm seeing that, and I'm seeing how that shift is coming about, and how society is, and their opinions on that are sort of changing. And I'm seeing that now, and kind of, maybe because I've been exposed to that so recently, now I'm looking back on Dracula from 1931 and kind of seeing, kind of projecting something on it that maybe wasn't intended. But I wonder if that's necessarily a bad thing, because I think there's, I don't know, there's something a little bit more menacing, I think, in a character or a villain or a monster that you are not safe no matter what gender you are. It doesn't matter if you're a male, or if you're a female. You are a sack of meat to this monster. And, I mean, if we're if we are taking that initial metaphor of sexually transmitted disease, and if we're taking that to its logical conclusion, that is not something that sees gender. You know, you can infect a male with AIDS or HIV just like you can infect a female with AIDS or HIV. You know, viruses don't see gender. Except I suppose the argument could be made for HPV. That is not an argument I am going to make on this podcast because I know nothing about science. So I'm not going to make that argument. But it's just saying, you know, sex, being a sexual predator and spreading disease, those are something which those are terrors and horrors for everybody involved. But maybe it just made people a little bit more uncomfortable in 1931 to think of a male doing that to another male versus a male doing that to a female. Because also in 1931, women were not as respected as they are now. So it was maybe at that time a little bit more okay to kind of see a woman as an object to this monster. Although, of course, there's a happy ending. despite that, Dracula, another thing that I realized watching it again is, this movie, I don't want to say this movie is bad. This movie has a lot of problems. And a lot of those problems are, like, really obvious, blatant problems. I'm not talking where it's like, oh, I was upset by how, you know, by how this scene reads, or maybe in, like, a glitch here and there. I mean, there are bad continuity errors in this Dracula movie. And there are entire shots that, once again, maybe I'm noticing this now because I'm watching this on a Blu-ray in a large screen, high definition TV, where maybe this is something I didn't notice when I was seeing this, I don't know, maybe in a smaller TV, maybe 10 years or so ago, but there are entire shots that are out of focus in this, or where the focus is weird, at least in the sense of the characters in the foreground are out of focus, but the background is in sharp focus. Those are glaring technical mistakes, and there are glaring continuity errors, and there's also some troublesome performances. Like I said, the guy who plays Renfield, whose name is currently escaping me, but I'm looking it up right now, it is Dwight Frye. And I actually thought it was David Manners who was playing Renfield, because Gavin complained so much about how bad David Manners was that when I saw a bad performance, I assumed, oh, there's David Manners. David Manners is actually John Harker, who I don't think is great, but I don't think is the worst part of this movie either. Not even from a character standpoint. I think that either has to go to Renfield or the guy who played his caretaker. Once again, the bumbling comedic duo who I think is just wildly out of place in this movie. But I wonder how much of that also had to do with Todd Browning, because it's weird. There are really sharp continuity errors here, and there's sort of two stories as to what led to that. The first one is Todd Browning said that there was a lot of studio interference, that they wanted him to you know... Once again, we talked about this in the introductory episode, Gavin and I. There are some things the studios have been doing for generations. Interfering in their artists' movies is one of those things. So Todd Browning said that this movie, that the studio kept interfering with this movie. But other sources, and this is easy enough to Google, or just go to the Internet Movie Database like I did, said that Todd Browning was despondent because of a couple of years earlier, his friend Lon Chaney had died. Lon Chaney from the original Phantom of the Opera, which I will be getting to in 2 weeks from now, had died, I think, about a year or two later. So he was despondent. He had no interest in doing this film, would rip pages of the script right out, and then would often leave the set, leaving Carl Freund, his cinematographer, to direct the movie. So it also seems like there was a guy here, a director in charge of this picture, who also really had no interest in making this picture, and just sort of did whatever he could to just kind of get through, which would certainly explain why there's a lot of out-of-focus shots, because what the fuck? What do I care? You know, let's just shoot this and get it done and move on. But then there's also some scenes, not scenes, but then there's also, you know, some things which I also wonder how much had to do with the fact that with the stock market crash in 1929, the studio kind of cut the budget for this. Obviously, not obviously, but initially what they wanted to do was make something which is a lot more ambitious, based more on Bram Stoker's novel, but because the budget was slashed so much, they instead had to kind of base it on the stage play, which by proxy of just being a stage production, was a little bit more smaller scale. So you have those kind of three things all sort of making a perfect storm of a movie which is actually terribly flawed on a basic technical standpoint, which is really difficult. There's some level of forgiveness you can kind of give to an old movie, especially a silent film, which, speaking of silent film, the ship sequence in which Dracula is coming over to Transylvania or to England from Transylvania was pulled from an old silent film. And that's why it seems out of place, because since it was shot as an old silent film, they kind of had to change the frame rate of it to match this movie. And so that's why you get people who are moving a little bit quicker, and it's just really out of place. And once again, that's kind of an error which kind of comes down to how is this film mishandled on a technical level? And those moments are actually kind of distracting. I actually remember texting Gavin, you know, while I was watching the movie, like, there are some out-of-focus shots in this, and, like, blatantly out-of-focus shots if you can see on a big enough screen. And it's I wonder how much that has to do with, you know, the making of it and how in tune Todd Browning was to making this. But at the same time, on a larger scale, the success of this movie allowed Todd Browning to make Freaks. And I have to be thankful for that, because Freaks is an absolutely fantastically upsetting horror film. So let's get into The Mummy. That was a perfect segue, right? It was seamless, I'm pretty sure. And The Mummy, in my opinion, is actually a much better film than Dracula. And I don't know if I don't think that is consensus. Let me just take a look here right now. Maybe it is. Anyway, but Dracula is certainly the more important film, or at least the one that, like I said, Bela Lugosi's Dracula kind of became the iconic version of Dracula, which spawned sequels with Bela Lugosi and with that specific character, whereas The Mummy, despite the fact that there are quote-unquote sequels for The Mummy, they're not of this this particular iteration of The Mummy. And for some reason, The Mummy as a monster, The Mummy as an other, hasn't seemed to catch on historically and culturally like Frankenstein's monster did, or like Dracula did, or like in the 80s, Freddy Krueger or Jason Voorhees did. And I wonder why that is. I wonder how much of that has to do with iconography of image, because the mummy makeup for Boris Karloff, specifically when he is, you know, recently reawakened, you know, we see him for, what, a couple seconds at the very beginning. That is fantastic, but it's also, there's nothing individual or specific about it. You think of Dracula and you can kind of think of his hairstyle, his uniform, his cape. You can think of Frankenstein's monster. You can think of the flat top and the bolts and the dead eyes. And the Wolfman, obviously, is the Wolfman. But the mummy, it's like there's nothing specific about the look of the mummy as the mummy that kind of makes him, that kind of separates him. Because story-wise, he is very unique. That's kind of redundant saying very unique. But he is certainly unique, and he is certainly, in my opinion, a much more interesting character than Dracula, at least in regards to the background of his story and the mythology behind him. Also, as a film on a technical level, it's just a lot sharper, it's a lot smoother, it's a lot more efficient. Carl Freund, and maybe this is because he had the experience as a cinematographer, directed The Mummy, and it's just the shot composition makes sense, the way things are edited together, there's not the continuity errors. He uses light and shadow in a lot more interesting ways. I mean, in Dracula, even in you know, the basement scene in Castle Dracula, it was all brightly lit, and you saw everything. There was, you know, you saw everything that was, like, you know, feet and feet behind him. Everything was very clear. Whereas The Mummy, there's a specific scene that takes place in the museum where the lights are off, and all we're seeing is our POV is through the flashlight of a security guard who is looking for where's the source of this. Well, it's Imhotep, you know, kind of hunkered down trying to get his curse on. And that's just really, there was, I have to imagine at the time it was innovative, but I was certainly kind of preparing myself for there's going to be a jump scare or there's going to be something tense and scary here. And it didn't play out like that, but at least it kind of gave me something, which kind of like, oh, okay, here's something I wasn't expecting. And just, like I said, shot composition, how scenes are edited together, and also sort of going more for the, and this may be very boring to some people, but like the shot, you know, the master shot and then shot reverse shot kind of way to establish a conversation. Yeah, I guess it's very by the book, but there's something that's very smooth and reliable about that. There's a language to cinema and a language to editing, which I see spoken more fluently in The Mummy than I saw it spoken in Dracula. And that, a lot of that, I'm sure, has to do with the continuity errors that resulted in things that Browning didn't shoot. But it also, I think, was resulting in maybe the production was, I don't know, if the production of Dracula wasn't rushed, it certainly felt rushed because of how it was just, here's the camera, we're going to put it here, you two are going to stand here and have this entire conversation, and I'm not going to cut away to anything. And sometimes it works, like in the conversations in Castle Dracula at the very beginning, and sometimes it's a little bit weird, and you're wondering why they're not cutting back and forth, like, for instance, when Van Helsing is on the terrace, or I guess it's the terrace, the patio, whatever, talking to Mina and Jonathan Harker. And we're at Van Helsing's back the entire time. We never really see his face. And that's weird, and I'm not sure why that does it. And it feels like you were doing it because Browning didn't care and he was just trying to rush it through, whereas Freund seemed to take a lot more care with this production. And it certainly seemed like that because there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stories in which Carl Freund and Zita Johann, the woman who plays Helen, were at each other's throats, and they were reportedly they were both miserable with working with each other. But The Mummy is technically a much better picture. In terms of the story, The Mummy, Imhotep, as played by Boris Karloff, also played wonderfully by Boris Karloff, is an interesting character. Certainly the villain of the piece, but a three-dimensional villain. You know, we kind of, if we're not on board with him, we can at least kind of understand where he's coming from. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we find out his backstory. We know why he was buried. We know why he is pursuing this female love interest. When we have to kind of admire in a way that, like, oh, so he's casting curses on people. Yes, he is putting people under his control, and yes, he murders somebody, but it's all because he is in love with this woman that he sees to be, or sees to have to be the reincarnated spirit of the woman he loved 3,700 years ago. You know, he's murderous and he is evil, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, there's a saying that hatred is an extension of love. You know, you might hate an ex because of the love that you once shared for them and the hurt that love is no longer there. But Imhotep is certainly evil and certainly is out to kill people and to command people, because what he wants to do is get back the woman that he loved, the woman who was lost to him back when he lived in ancient Egypt. Well, they're still in Egypt, but in ancient Egypt, and the one who he was buried alive. That's fucking brutal, guys. He was buried alive because he was trying to invoke dark powers to bring back the woman he loved. And there's something that's horrible, but there's something that's tragic and kind of admirable about that too. And the fact that we have this interesting backstory behind it makes it a bit more interesting film. It makes it a little bit more, you know, gives the film more of an arc and gives it more of a development. Unlike Dracula, it's kind of like from the get-go, it's like we have Dracula who is bad, and we have these guys who are good, and then it's just kind of it until the end, and there's not a whole lot of surprises to how things play out, and it's a lot more about it's a lot more about the atmosphere and sort of this iconography, you know the evil iconography, but also the good iconography and the crucifix and all that kind of stuff. It's sort of more of a good versus evil, whereas The Mummy, that blurs it a little bit. And makes it a little bit more interesting. And I think it's also interesting in how The Mummy sort of also, I think, blurs it by getting rid of religion, if you will. The crucifix is certainly no longer a factor. God and I guess this source of good is no longer there. There's a substitute for it in the Ankh and for, I guess, Isis and Osiris. But I guess there's less of it when you're, whether you believe in Christianity or spirituality or not, there's enough iconography and sort of a lot of its tenements sort of exist in our general awareness enough where we can kind of, when you have a movie which sort of introduces the Bible or a cross and then the antithesis of that, we know where the battle lines are drawn. This is bad, this is good, et cetera. But when we kind of step outside of that, and I think especially for American audiences, when we step outside of that and kind of see, like, okay, so is this ancient Egyptian religion? I'm not really sure about this. So what's good and what's bad? It becomes a little bit murkier. And instead we sort of have to, at least for this movie, I think we kind of instead have to rely on, well, what are the characters revealing for us? And the characters in this are certainly interesting, or at least the character of Imhotep is a lot more interesting to me than the character of Dracula, or at least I should say the character of Imhotep in this iteration of The Mummy is a lot more interesting to me than the Dracula in the iteration of the 1931 Dracula. Certainly, I think once you get into, I love this movie personally. I know a lot of people are not a fan of it, and I'm not really sure why, but once you get into Coppola's Dracula in 1990, I believe, and you have Gary Oldman, I think that depiction of Count Dracula and that iteration of it is very fascinating to me. And it's actually kind of funny because I think, you know, Dracula of 1931 and The Mummy from 1932 had a baby, and that baby turned into Coppola's 1990 Dracula, because you certainly have some of the plot, you know, the basic plot structure of Dracula from 1931. You have the Count in Renfield, and he is moving from Transylvania to Carfax Abbey, and you have his fascination with Mina Harker, and you have Jonathan Harker in there, and you have Van Helsing in there. But then you also take from The Mummy this idea of this this ancient character who is motivated by the love and passion he feels for someone that he believed he loved in the past. You know, Coppola's film takes both of those elements and kind of combines them into this wonderfully surreal physics-bending and defying horror film, which has a love story out of the heart of it and also has some really cool practical in-camera effects and a fantastic performance from Gary Oldman, also pretty good performance from Anthony Hopkins, and some not-so-great performances from both Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder, but the less we talk about it, the better. And also, like I said, Boris Karloff is great in The Mummy. How he has that imposing form that he kind of, you know, that we also saw in that, you know, well, not for the purposes of this episode, but what we also see in the original Frankenstein, how he has that imposing character, but he also has he's got an intimidation factor and a freakiness about him, but he also has a, but there's also a mystery and sort of he carries sort of a heartache and a tragedy with him, and I think that's due to how expressive Boris Karloff is. And then, of course, Zita Johann, the woman who plays Helen, she is also gorgeous. And not even in the sense of, like, oh, she's 1930s gorgeous. Like, no, she is just a gorgeous woman. So I have to say that watching her instead was also a delight for me. Or at least, it was nice, guys. So then I guess let's talk now about kind of the similarities between these two, because Gavin was mentioning it in the introductory episode about how The Mummy is essentially a spiritual sequel or a spiritual remake of Dracula. And I was skeptical for the first, like, 15, 20 minutes of this movie, but no, they are spiritually the same exact movie. I mean, sure, let me kind of read it here. You have these monsters who are, you know, introduced into an environment which is unfamiliar to them. For Dracula, you have it geographically. He goes from his home country to England, and then in The Mummy, you have Imhotep waking up almost 4,000 years after his time. So it's, you know, it's a geographical unfamiliarity versus a chronological unfamiliarity. But you have a what seems to be a female love interest for both monsters. Dracula certainly seems to have a fascination with Mina. It isn't really explored in too much detail, but certainly it is very much explored with The Mummy, between, you know, Imhotep and Helen. You have a powerful symbol which represents a higher power, which is a deterrent. In Dracula, you have the crucifix and the cross, which repels him. In The Mummy, you have the Ankh instead, the Ankh of, is it Iris or Osiris? Osiris. But you have that Ankh, which is supposed to be the one that repels him, which kind of keeps him back. You have this idea of fear of the outsider. And I think this isn't something which is so explicit, more of sort of an undercurrent, but this idea of this person, this monster creature, is outside of who we are, of what we're used to, and there's sort of that makes this person evil. Yes, The Mummy takes place in Egypt, but our main characters are English people. They're English people living in Cairo, and Imhotep is the native Egyptian there, and he is also the bad guy, and Count Dracula is from Transylvania, you know, and this third world backwater seemingly country, you know, where there are, you know, small villages filled with, you know, peasants essentially who are superstitious, and you know, he comes to England, which is very technologically advanced, and where you have science and technology and innovation, and this man is an outsider in there, and there's a fear of that. You even have actors who are in each movie. You have David Manners who plays Jonathan Harker in The Mummy, and then he also plays Frank Wemple. Is it Wemple or Welper? Anyway, he plays the main young man in The Mummy, who is supposed to be the love interest of Helen. That's a creepy, weird relationship that doesn't really work out too well, mainly because he's a very bland, milquetoast kind of guy who kind of immediately falls in love with this woman who passes out outside of a museum under the curse of a mummy. But, you know, tomato, tomato, to each his own. I'm not going to judge how you met your missus. And then you also have Edward Van Sloan, who plays Van Helsing in Dracula, and then plays a character named Dr. Mueller in The Mummy, but they are essentially the same character. They are pretty much the exact same character, in the sense of how they are authoritative characters. You know, he's a professor in Dracula, he's a doctor in The Mummy, who have this knowledge, who somehow have, you know, who are the gatekeeper of this knowledge, of this ancient power. Not just of where that comes from, but how to defeat it as well. Which also ties into this idea of what I'd mentioned. Mythology versus science as solutions to the problem. Because while I do think that you have this undercurrent of fear of the outsider, not just in these movies, but in monster movies in general, but you certainly have this idea that there is something scary about these characters because they are outside of us. They are the other with a capital O. And what I love about this movie... You know what, before I kind of get further on that, let me tie into this, because this sort of ties into... I mentioned there was a comment on my introductory episode with a person who... I don't know whether it's a him or her. They, I'll just say the general, they go by Fiction Isn't Real, as their handle on battleshippretension.com, where the episode was posted. And Fiction, Mr. or Mrs. Fiction Isn't Real, if you're listening to this, I'm not calling you out to chastise you at all, but just to kind of introduce what you said as a point that I can get into for the next point that I go to make. But essentially the comment kind of came down to the idea of intent versus meaning, it kind of came down to. So, he or she, they says, I'm much more suspicious than Gavin of reading things into horror movies based on the time they were made. Countless people have written about how Invasion of the Body Snatchers is supposed to be about the Cold War, when the book's author always insisted it was just a pulpy thriller and the director denied he added anything political to it. Similarly, I've read many people saw Cronenberg's Fly is about AIDS, when Cronenberg himself said it was inspired by his parents' aging. And that's in response to this idea of Gavin and I obviously talking about how what was happening in American society fed into these monster movies specifically, and how the monster movie has evolved and changed over time. And I responded to it. I got a little snooty because I name-dropped Christian Metz, who is a film critic who I believe at film school is serving me properly now, I believe was a disciple of Sigmund Freud. And he had a little idea that, you know, Christian Metz theorized, and I wrote this, that one of the reasons film is popular is due to its ability to be an imperfect mirror of reality. And that idea that whether the director or we realize it or not, the director is always going to reflect society to some degree. And I phrase it as sort of it's trying to prove a negative, but I don't see how society can't influence art, you know what I mean? Even on the subconscious level, which is kind of a cop-out argument, like, well, you can't argue against the subconscious because you're not even really sure it's there, or at least you're not even really sure how it's affecting you. It just is to some degree that you don't understand. But I don't see how society can't influence art, especially when you have art in the wake of horrible tragedies such as the stock market crash of 1929, or World War II, or 9/11, or drone strikes or surveillance, you know, modern day things like that. I don't see how that can't influence it, because it is influencing everything else that is around you. And on top of that, I also wonder, this is a larger question, just that idea of intent versus meaning. So for instance, yes, David Cronenberg didn't intend for, and I'm getting a little off topic here, but David Cronenberg didn't intend for The Fly to be a metaphor about AIDS. It intended to be a metaphor just about aging and deterioration of the body in general, something which he saw even more relevant when he watched it, you know, for its, I think it was its 20th or 25th anniversary, and did a commentary track for it. It was even more relevant to them because obviously he was decades older. But now, I also don't think David Cronenberg would say that interpreting it as a metaphor for the AIDS virus would detract from the film, because that's not what he intended for, because that reading and that meaning allowed the film to have a resonance and a relevance to other people during the time. Now, if Ridley Scott came out and said, like, hey, I don't give a shit about postmodern philosophy, I don't care about questions of how technology and philosophy is changing us, would that mean that Blade Runner was any less of a great film? If Neil Marshall came out and said, like, hey, I don't I don't think he would say he doesn't care about women, but like, oh yeah, I mean, The Descent, like, oh yeah, sure, you're reading that about an analysis of psychological trauma for women or events that can shape the lives of women, such as, such as childbirth. You know, there's a scene at the end where the main character is emerging from a hole in the ground, which very much, you know, kind of mirrors a baby coming out of the womb. If he would say, like, hey, that's not what I intended at all, that wouldn't make it any less of a meaningful or powerful film for me, because that's how I've interpreted things, and that's the meaning that I've assigned to it, and that's what makes it a more enjoyable experience for me. And I don't want to say that director intent doesn't mean anything at all, but I guess I'm not as interested in intent versus what it means to me based on other factors. Because a lot of times it's these other factors which are allowing it to be a powerful and resonant film for me. A lot of times it's the context and it's the environment which I am in, which put me in such a place and puts my brain in such a formed place where it can be influenced by this movie that I'm seeing, which is also why I can see a movie now and love it, whereas 10 years ago I didn't, or 10 years ago I did love a movie and I sit down and I watch it now and I didn't, and I don't love it. You know, I sat down now and watched Dracula and saw something that was asexual, or at least gender agnostic about it. I didn't see that the last time I watched it. I don't think I would have. I would not have seen that if I watched Dracula in college. So there is a context for me on an individual level, which has very much been shaped by what has been happening in society and how society has been influencing me and helping me grow. So Todd Browning may not have meant any of that for Dracula. In fact, it certainly seems like Todd Browning didn't care about Dracula. Carl Froon may not have cared about this metaphor of the other. Or maybe Carl Froon was actually actively antagonistic towards non-Caucasians. I'm not sure. But the fact that I am seeing both of these horror films and just monster movies in general as sort of something about the other as a capital O, and fear of the other and fear of what is outside of us and you know, kind of worrying about how these enemies or these others are going to infect or pollute us, the fact that I'm seeing it that way is causing me to enjoy these films more, is causing me to see something in them that allows them to be transcendent, that allows them to continue to have power as the decades go on. And I guess I go on this long tangent to kind of bring up this idea of the big thing that I saw tying these two movies together, and one of the biggest things that I love about horror movies is this idea of mythology versus science. Because if there is a fear of the outsider in both of these movies, there is also the theme or the point that it's also the outsider who is going to save you, or at least it's also the person who has knowledge of this world that the outsider, that the other is from, who is going to save you. Because who is the knowledgeable one? Who is the one that has, that shares the wisdom in order to save everybody from Dracula and from the mummy? It's Van Helsing in Dracula. It's Dr. Mueller in the mummy. Both of them are others or outsiders as well. It's not really stated where Van Helsing comes from, but it's clear based on his accent, he is also not an Englishman. He's probably not from Transylvania, but he is not, you know, he is not a local, he is not native to this atmosphere or this environment where all this stuff is transpiring. It's also not entirely clear where Dr. Mueller is from either. Once again, it's clear he's not Egyptian, and he may be English, because everybody else seems to be. But he is at least in this world, he is in Cairo, he is in Egypt, I mean, he has a knowledge of that mythology. Van Helsing has an intimate knowledge of the vampire mythology. How do these characters come about this? We don't know. I'm not entirely interested in how they came about it. What I am interested in is that they both admit science is not going to do it. We need to look outside of ourselves to a power which is bigger than us in order to solve this problem. And that's one thing that I love, love, love about horror movies. Some people may find it a bit of a contradiction that I am a spiritual Christian person, but I am also really into horror movies, except when it gets to horror movies, it's one of the only times where it's not just okay for a mythology to be introduced into it, a mythology which in real life we may not believe in and we may not even care about, not only is it okay, in the world of horror movies, it is actively encouraged to believe in mythology, to believe in legend, and to look outside yourself and outside the bounds of your physical reality in order to find a solution. It kind of opens the door to its own sort of spirituality, and that's what I really love, and that's what I see is a common between Dracula and the Mummy. And you know, one of the biggest things, you know, on the surface level, there's so much stuff there which, like, yeah, wow, this really resembles Dracula. But the thing that I love the most about both of these, what they share in common, is that idea, is that it gets to a point where it's like, hey, what you know of the world, forget it, because there is something outside of that, and we need to engage with that now. We need to engage with this power on its terms, no longer on ours. And that's something that I really truly love, and that's something that I really appreciate about both these movies, and that's why I'm probably always going to be a horror fan as long as I live, and that's probably also why I am more inclined to like these gothic classics and these the paranormal stories, the ghost stories, and that sort of stuff over the people stories. Yes, one of my favorite films of all time, one of my top 10 favorite films of all time, which if you listen to my More Than One Lesson episode that I posted on the Facebook page, you would know this, is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is very much people on people. But the ones that I love watching around Halloween, the ones that I love turning on again and again when it comes, when October comes around and the weather gets colder and it starts getting darker earlier and the leaves start changing, I love watching the ghost movies. I love watching the things that go bump in the night. I'm not as interested in the stuff about people on people, because those horrors happen all the time. Those horrors, you know, we see those on a daily basis. But around October and around Halloween time, it's okay to kind of start, you know, opening ourselves up a little bit and wondering, but what if there were ghosts? What if there were demons? What if there was creatures and monsters, you know, hiding in the shadows? And that, and I love that idea. I love just that thought of there's something outside of us, man. Because I find that really spooky. But that's just me. If you want to watch either Dracula or the Mummy, it is super easy to do so. Dracula is, you can, it's available for rental or purchase on iTunes, on Google Play, on Vudu, and in both the PlayStation and the Microsoft stores. The Mummy, unfortunately, you will not be able to find that to rent, on iTunes, but you can get it to rent or stream through Amazon, rent or stream through Google Play, also rent or stream through to Vudu as well. Or if you have it, and I would recommend, honestly, I'd recommend a blind buy of this, you can watch it the same way I did, in which there is the Universal Classics or Universal Classic Monsters Blu-ray collection. It has 8 films in there, including both of these. So I didn't have to pay anything because I bought this 2 years ago and I watched it for free. Hopefully I remember to post a link to that on the Facebook page so that you can see it and you can check it out if you want to. It's just great. If nothing else, you know, you have the history, and there's all sorts of commentary tracks, which are absolutely wonderful. And I believe for Dracula, you can also watch the Spanish version that they were shooting at night on the same exact sets, which I'll probably go back and check out one of these days. But yeah, I think that's pretty much it for me. I ended up talking a lot more than I thought I would, and it seems like this format should be okay, so I'll probably return to this next week. Of course, it is always easy to get a hold of me. You can shoot me a line at youdomoviesbadly@gmail.com. Find this Facebook page on Facebook for I Do Movies Badly. I am Nolan Fixes Teeth on Twitter, and if you want to catch up with back episodes or leave comments, you can do that on both BattleshipRetention.com, where you go to podcasts and the drop down menu, do I Do Movies Badly, or on iTunes. Once again, fiction isn't real. I hope I made it clear that I was not chastising you, that instead I was just kind of using your comment to get into a larger conversation about a larger point I wanted to make. I certainly am not trying to call you out in a negative way. I am very thankful that you left a comment, and I read this one out specifically because I get so little feedback and I get so little comments that because I saw this as an opportunity to kind of have a larger conversation about something I wanted to read out. But I do thank you for listening. I do thank you for your feedback. I always appreciate feedback from everybody, whether positive or negative. I love having this dialogue. I love having this conversation and continuing it. So please don't feel afraid or nervous to do that, even if you disagree with me. Because as we see, it's it's perfectly fine to disagree with me, and this is just an opportunity to continue the conversation further. Because as of right now, I'm here in my apartment by myself, trying to drown out Monday Night Football, and being really grateful that my radiator has not acted up yet. But yeah, so please feel free. And fiction isn't real. I hope you listen to this episode. I hope you listen to the next episode. The next episode, of course, if you tune in next week, is going to be the... how did I forget what next week is? Oh, yes. Next week is Dracula's Daughter and the Invisible Man. So tune in for that second double feature, and well, hopefully I'll be just a little bit less ignorant.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.